developing the product. But there is the other component which is very important, is the assessment of the quality of research or quality of the study that we are, or intervention that you are trying to do to these people. And this is a whole field of expertise that also you need to be aware of. And so it's a professor of medicine, he's one of the leading experts on assessment of quality of life, for example, around the quality of outcome studies. And so he will give another overview about what this is about. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Okay. I tried to put the essential information up here. You might want to note this. I think it's probably in the handout anyway, so you don't have to write it down. But that's just later if you want to go and download the updated version of this as well as other PowerPoint presentations and other material. I, as was said, I'm at the Department of Medicine, Division of General Internal Medicine and Health Services Research, and full-time there. I'm also at RAND part-time as a consultant. I started out at RAND in 1984 and then came over to UCLA in 1997 full-time in the division that I'm in right now. And what I focused on in my work has been health-related quality of life and patient evaluations of care and also patient health related behaviors primarily, but we do a variety of research, but those are the main areas of emphasis. So that's what I want to talk about today. And so really, I want to just introduce the idea of using health-related quality of life as an outcome measure in studies and what the overriding issues are, just touching the surface. And you have to follow up, of course, with greater detail yourself by looking at the existing literature, and some of you may be more or less familiar with it already. But as a start, the reason you might be interested in even considering health-related quality of life is shown in this diagram above, where health outcomes, and again, this isn't very bright here, so I'll just try to let you see this, but you could think of health outcomes as one of the major objectives of healthcare. And when you focus on that, we often will look at clinical measures, and that's this box right here. So there's standard clinical parameters like blood pressure and blood sugar and other indicators of how someone's doing in their health. But what we're talking about is another type of health indicator, health-related quality of life, this other box. And that's a patient-reported measure of their health. So that's what we're going to be talking about, is a complementary measure that comes from the patient directly. So it's intended to be correlated with clinical measures, but certainly has a lot of unique information in it and is valuable by itself. You could also be interested in the link between process of care, doesn't seem to show it very well here, but process of care and health outcomes. And when you talk about process of care, you can measure that using expert opinion, which would tell you about technical quality of care. And I don't know if you've gotten much in the way of an introduction to that in this class. I don't remember too much of that, but Bob Brook is pretty famous here at UCLA and RAND for that kind of work, and there's a lot of physicians that have focused on how do you define technical quality of care. Basically, if you're a given type patient and you should get certain type of care under those circumstances, and using that expert input, you can define how good the care has been for a person in a technical sense. But you can also go to the patient directly and ask them what they think about their care, and that's what I'm calling interpersonal quality of care. Again, it's complementary information because you don't want to ask the patient what they think about the care in a technical sense. They're not going to get you very good data in that regard, but they'll tell you some good information about how well the doctor communicated and whether they had access to care and so forth. And for this purpose, I'm just focused on the interpersonal, which would include communication and the art of care more generally. So you would often be interested in the link of these two things, process of care and health outcomes, and you can get multiple sources of data of each. So just illustrating this a little bit more, with the process of care, as I already said, you've got this expert consensus that's going to tell you about technical quality, and sort of the standard right now is if you have this set of characteristics as a patient, that means that something should happen in terms of the care you get. So, for example, with diabetes, you can look at the percentage of people who have their hemoglobin A1C test annually because they should be getting these. They should be getting at least one of those annually. So by defining a group of patients that have diabetes, you can look at the percentage of them that have actually gotten this degree of care that's been defined by experts. And you don't just look at one of these things. There's a whole range of things that might apply to a given patient, and you basically summarize the extent to which they got what they should have gotten from care. But you can also ask them what they think about care in terms of communication. So one instrument is the consumer assessment of healthcare providers and systems. It's a standard instrument developed by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Policy, and CMS uses this. And one of the questions it's asked is of this type: in the last 12 months, how often did your doctor explain things in a way that was easy to understand? So that's the kind of thing that the patient can tell you. You know, are they receiving information from the doctor in a way that they can understand? Is the doctor listening to them? Those sorts of things. That's what you want to go to the patient for. You don't want to ask them about technical quality of care. And when you look at the health outcome side, clinically, you can also have indicators just like we did for process of care. And with diabetes, you can look at the percentage of diabetics who had poor hemoglobin A1C levels. They were out of control, essentially. So just like you can look and see, did they get the test that they should get? And other indicators of care, you can also look at the outcomes. Are they in control or out of control? That's a clinical-based approach. And then you can get patients to tell you what they feel about their health. So the most general way you would do it is some question like this one here. Would you say that in general your health is excellent, very good, good, fair, poor? So this is, if people are going to pick one item to represent what we're talking about in terms of health-related quality of life, this is going to be the single item that people will use as an example. It's the most general item you could ask, and you're asking the patient really to summarize everything in terms of the bottom line with 5 response choices. And that sort of gives you an idea about how they're doing from their perspective in terms of their health. And just to make this a little bit more complicated, when you're looking at the link between process and health outcomes, you're typically not going to focus just on those two circles. There are other characteristics that you need to take into account, especially because a lot of the research that's done here is not experimental. People are not randomized to the care that they get, unless it's a randomized clinical trial where they're focused on one specific treatment. When you're looking at people in care on an ongoing basis, you're just observing what happens to them, and you're trying to link variation and process to outcomes. And when you do that, you need to control for a lot of other characteristics to have a better sense of what's the impact of process of care on outcomes. And so there are many characteristics you can control for, but patient characteristics are very important. And one category would be patient behavior. So process of care can have a direct effect on their health outcomes, but it also may have an indirect effect through patient adherence and other patient behaviors. So that's what this is showing here. Just wish this thing was... my battery's low, it's just too late. But right through there would be the indirect effect. And so even if there isn't an effect through process of care, patient behavior still can affect health outcomes, so you need to control for that. And then patient characteristics. So some patients, older patients, less educated patients, and so on, may have different behaviors, and that may also lead, you may have some direct effects on health outcomes that vary by patient characteristics. So when this work is being done, you need to control for other variables in order to get the best possible inference about what you're interested in showing. Just to illustrate how complicated it can get, you could take a look at this article that was published in Health Services Research in 2007. It actually received this award, the Eisenberg Award. John Eisenberg, who was the head of AHRQ, Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, a physician, and he has died, and an award was designated in his honor. But this is the award that's given to the best article published in that year for health services research. So in 2007, the best article that was in that journal was published by Catherine Kahn and colleagues here at UCLA and RAND. And what it did was show that there is a link between process of care and health outcomes in the expected direction. That may sound very simplistic, but this was a set of people with a variety of chronic conditions, some without conditions, but looking at care in general for people in managed care, primarily located in California, about 1,000 patients, and looking to see when they received better process of care, did that lead to better health-related quality of life outcomes. and indeed that was shown to be the case. But in order to do that, there was some very sophisticated analysis that had to be done that you can read about in the article. But basically, it involved instrumental variables approach, where if you look at the data by itself without doing a sophisticated statistical analysis, it actually looks like better process of care leads to worse outcomes. So when you first take a look at the data, you can actually see something like that that's counterintuitive, and that's because there's unmeasured differences in severity of illness in patients when you're naturally observing them. So it gets very complicated in terms of trying to disentangle the selection bias that's in a lot of this data, and one way to do that is this technique that's known as instrumental variables, where you find a variable that's related to process, but it's not related to outcomes of care, and that helps you get a better sense of the link between process and outcomes of care. So this is just to let you know that going into this and trying to do these kind of evaluations is not necessarily as straightforward as you'd like it to be. It requires very rigorous and intensive analysis to show something that you think is actually there in truth in the data. Okay, so that was just a general introduction to the kind of ways that these things get used. Now, going back to what health-related quality of life includes, I just basically introduced the idea with a single item, global rating, but there's more to it than that. When we're talking about health-related quality of life, this is the patient's report about their health. What it boils down to is two main things. One is, how is the patient feeling about their life, basically? Are they happy, sad, depressed, anxious, and so on? And so these feelings about their life are internal subjective perceptions. So the reason that health-related quality of life is a patient-reported measure is largely because these are things that are very difficult to get in any other way. You really have to ask the patient directly. So whether they're in pain or not is an indicator of their feelings or well-being, and if they have a lot of energy or not. That's something that really requires that you ask the patient. It's hard for you to get that data by observing them even. I mean, you may look at someone and you can tell they're in pain, but you're not always certain. They may be hiding that pain from you. Or you may think they're in pain, but they're actually feeling quite well. They may look tired. You know, they're sort of yawning or looks like they're laying their head down. And that may tell you something about their energy level, but you really need to go to them directly to be sure. So the well-being piece is the more subjective internal perceptions and really requires the patient to tell you about it. The second piece is the behavioral piece. So in addition to how they feel about their health part of their life, we're also interested in what they can do. And in theory, this is more observable than the internal subjective feeling part of health-related quality of life, but typically this data is still collected by self-report because it's difficult to get it. Even if you could get it by observation, it's very difficult to get people to observe someone else on a regular basis or over an extended period of time. Given that you're with yourself 24 hours a day, no one else typically is with you all that time, you know best about what you can do. So what we talk about in terms of behavioral piece ranges from the most basic behavior, self-care. So can they bathe and dress themselves? But it also goes on to include a lot of other behaviors. So there's a lot of physical functioning activities that go on from walking, running, vigorous activities of various types. And then we're interested in what we call role function, which is can they carry out their work, whether it's paid work or volunteer work, whatever is appropriate for that person. It could be housework, whatever their role function is for their stage of life and their particular characteristics. And we're interested in their social function. So that means how well do they get along with family, friends, and other people. So health-related quality of life, in terms of its conceptualization, is going to include these two main areas, the how you feel about life and what you can do, and then you take that as a starting point to then measure it by asking people a series of questions. So typically it's either a telephone interview or it might be a self-administered paper questionnaire. Nowadays it's more and more on the internet where you ask people a series of questions that try to tap into each of these main areas and then go down into specific sub-areas within that in order to get a comprehensive assessment of how they feel about their health. And what you're trying to do is to cover physical, mental, and social aspects of health. How they feel, and what they're able to do in terms of physical, mental, and social health. And this comes out of the WHO, World Health Organization. Back in the 1950s, they came up with this idea of what's health. It includes physical, mental, and social aspects. Okay, so when we're measuring health-related quality of life in these studies, it's important to distinguish it from other concepts that some people would say, well, these other things are part of quality of life. And that's true, but when we're talking about health-related quality of life, we've got a subset of quality of life, because quality of life includes almost everything. But we're going to try to focus on the health piece of quality of life, and that's why it's called health-related quality of life. And one of the essential ingredients is that it ends at the skin of the individual. So what we're trying to measure here is something that really fits within that person directly. It doesn't extend out into their environment. So quality of the environment is not part of health-related quality of life. So if you live in a polluted place like L.A., or a clean environment, that could be very important in terms of your health or your health-related quality of life, but that's an external variable that's important to measure but not part of the measurement of health-related quality of life. And if they're in a very nice place, a mansion or a ghetto, whatever their housing may be, that is probably going to affect their health-related quality of life, how they feel about their life, and maybe what they can do ultimately. But it's something that we keep separate. It's something that's a causal variable potentially, but not part of health-related quality of life. And then income, if they have a lot of money, they're going to be able to get better access to health care and other things, better food and so forth. So that'll probably lead to better health, but it's something that we want to keep separate from health. And then finally, the closest thing might be something like social support. So you'll see existing measures that actually include social support as part of health-related quality of life. That's probably not a good idea. We would say social support is what's coming from the environment. So if our family, friends, and other people available to give you tangible support, emotional support, and so on, are they able to help you? That's something out there versus social function, which is how well you're able to get along with family, friends, and other people. They're very closely related. It's hard to draw that line, but we try to do that. We say social support is coming from out there. It can help you function and make you feel better about your health. But that is not, that's something we want to keep separate. Okay, so actually, now turning to the measurement, we already went through this as an example item, and this is the most widely used single item. If you look in the literature, if people are going to use one item, this is the one, because it gives them a general sense of how people are doing. And doctors will do this typically with patients. They'll ask these kind of general questions, not necessarily exactly like this, but basically, how are you doing? And if they wanted to phrase it in terms of health, how would you rate your health? And not necessarily with this response scale, but in research, this has been typically the default response scale that people have adopted. And so with one item, you can get a pretty good sense for how people feel about their health. Now, whether or not this is accurate is another question. So you don't assume that what the patient tells you is always exactly correct. They could be in a wheelchair and say their health is excellent. Maybe their health is excellent, but maybe it isn't. They could be someone who you would think is in excellent health, and they say their health is poor. So you don't always take what they say is exactly agreeing with what you would think they should say. But it's important information nonetheless, and it's often accurate in the sense of being reliable, that they'll consistently give you that information, and valid. For example, this item will predict mortality pretty well. So they're telling you really something pretty meaningful about their health. Doesn't mean for every individual you believe everything they say, but overall, it gives you pretty good information. An example of how that item is used is by the CDC. They've collected data since 1993 using this item and other questions just to map how the U.S. is doing in terms of what they feel about their health. And they cut that item up into the percentage of people who say their health is either fair or poor, which is the bottom two categories. So there's five response possibilities from excellent to poor. They look at the percentage who fall into the bottom two categories, poor or fair. And they divide it up by age groups. And they also divide it up by gender and other ways. But when you look at age groups, a higher score is worse because that's the bottom two categories. So this is the highest age category here. and this is the youngest age category here, and here's the intermediate age categories. And what you see is what you might expect, that older people are more likely to say that their health is not as good as younger people. And the difference is 33% falling into the bottom two categories in the oldest group, the 75 and older. And it's 9% for those who are in the youngest group of adults, 18 to 34. So maybe that's not too surprising, but it's somewhat comforting to know that at least it's not total random garbage that people are telling you. What they're telling you makes some sense. The other thing that's interesting is that you can look at the youngest age groups and see that it takes quite a while before you see much of a difference by age. The bottom three categories are pretty similar, and it isn't until you get to this age group that you start to see substantial differences in the percentage of the people that start to get towards middle age that say their health is either fair or poor. Okay, so that's the single item approach. If you're just trying to be very simplistic and get some valuable information, you would just use a single question. In general, we wouldn't recommend that you only use a single question if you really care very much about health-related quality of life, just like you wouldn't use a single clinical measure. To do a good job of measuring anything, you need multiple measures. And so a single item will give you some information, but more typically you would want to ask multiple questions. And the SF-36 is an example of a generic profile measure that has multiple questions. So health-related quality of life measures are going to fall into three main categories: generic profile, disease-targeted profile, and then a generic preference-based measure. The first type measure is the most widely used, is this generic profile measure. And that just means that it's generic in the sense that it's like an IQ test. It's designed that anyone could answer these questions, even though you have to verify whether that's really the case. It really doesn't literally apply to everybody, but most people should be able to answer the questions. And the SF-36 is designed for adults, 18 and older, although you can even go down to somewhat younger ages. But basically for adults, everybody can answer the question. That makes it generic. You could compare different people who answer the same question. And it's a profile in the sense that you're going to get multiple scores. And so there's a variety of these type of measures out there. But the SF-36, the reason I'm showing you that is because it was developed at RAND in the 1980s as part of the medical outcome study. And it has become the most widely used generic profile measure in the world, essentially. So if anyone's going to think of a generic profile measure, the first thing that's going to come to mind is the SF-36. The SF stands for short form. 36 means it has 36 questions. So it was derived out of much longer questionnaires that had over 100 items. But right now, it's very widely used because it gives you quite a bit of detail in a very quick way. So with 36 questions, you can ask people either in an interview or they can sit down and do an internet survey or do a mail survey. You can get a fair amount of information. And the rule of thumb for how long it would take for people to complete something like this is 3 to 5 items per minute. So with the SF-36, you know, that's going to be something like 7 to 10 minutes for people to complete. So as long as you're in a situation where you have that much time, you may be in an office setting and people are not maybe able to spend 7 to 10 minutes just doing an SF-36, you may have to do something else. But in a lot of cases, if you're doing a telephone interview, it's not such a big deal to have 7 to 10 minutes devoted to a measure of this type. And that's why people like it. And what you'll see is if you look at how the items distribute, you've got, just like I said before, you've got measures of functioning or what people can do, and then you have measures of well-being or what do they think about their life. And in functioning, you've got physical functioning that has 10 questions. So that's the scale that actually, when they're divided up like this, they're called scales. There are 8 of them. There are 4 that are measuring primarily functioning, 4 that are measuring primarily well-being. Each of those scales has more than one item. The minimum is 2, the maximum is 10. So the physical functioning scale has 10 questions in it, whereas you see social functioning has 2 and pain has 2. The reasons for the difference in the number of items is just that some concepts are more difficult to measure than others. That's part of it. Some of it is just the instrument developers just decided for whatever reason to put more emphasis on one thing than another. But it's sort of a variety of reasons. But in some cases, you really don't need as many items to capture the concept, or at least you don't know how to do it with any more items. So you at least want 2, but you don't necessarily need more than that in every case. So you've got the physical function, you've got role limitations, and in this particular scale it's kind of unique because it's role limitations that are due to either physical health problems or due to emotional problems. So the respondent is actually asked to make an attribution as to the reason that they're limited in their role function, their work, whether it's paid or unpaid work. Also their social function, they get along with family, friends, and other people. And then you've got a variety of things about well-being that we already basically hinted at or showed you. Emotional well-being is just anxiety, depression, positive affect. Energy, you would probably have a pretty good idea what that is. Pain, that's pretty straightforward. And then general health perceptions may not be as straightforward because the label may not tell you, but this is just like that item we looked at. In general, how would you rate your health? The most widely used single item, in general, how would you rate your health, is an example of a general health perception item. So it's general because you're asking people just how do they feel sort of overall. You don't have a really specific referent.
Do you use a number or a scale? What do you use?
1 to 10
or?
We'll show you in a second here some example items. So you'll see that these are just sort of laying out how many items go into each of these things, and then you got to. Then the next thing will be to show you some example items, and you'll see that there's a variety of ways that these get asked. They're basically the same structure. You'll have an item stem and response choices, just like you did with the in general. How would you rate your how would you rate your health item? But there's going to be different number of response choices depending on the concept and depending on the item. So they're not all the same. Some measures might have exactly the same response scale, but of course they're going to change the item stems because they're measuring different things. But in this case, with the SF-36, you're going to see a variety of different response option possibilities. So here's one example item now. There's the 36 questions. Actually, 35 of those go into the 8 scale scores. So there's a single item that doesn't get scored very often. That refers to change in health. So you can ignore that one and say there are 35 items that get used in scoring 8 different things. So that's why it's a profile, because you're going to get 8 different scores that are essentially the average of people's response to the items that represent that concept. And every item is going to be scored in the same direction so that a higher score is better, health-related quality of life. Now this is one example item here. And you can see the item stem is how much of the time during the past 4 weeks have you been happy. This is an example item that fits into that emotional well-being scale. The emotional well-being scale has 5 items in total. This is one of those items, and it's going to tap depression, anxiety, and positive affect. This is positive affect, how often you've been happy. So this is a positively worded item. Some of them are negatively worded, but basically it's how much of the time, and then the response scale is 5 response choices from none of the time to all of the time. So what's in common with these items is that they're always going to have an item stem like this, how much of the time part, and then they're always going to have a response set of response choices, and the response choices are going to vary. You might only have 2 response choices in some cases. You might have 5 or 6 response choices. In the SF-36, the current version of it, there's actually a second version now, version 2, the most response choices you'll ever have is 5. The minimum you could have in some cases, in some measures, is 2. And the reason for variation there is that if you're measuring certain things, some item stems and response choices just may be easier for people to understand or may fit the concept better. But as a general rule, the most people can distinguish is about 5 levels. So this is about as much degree of refinement that you can get out of people in their response choices. So you won't typically see very much more than 5 response choices that are offered, because that's all people can handle, and in some cases they can't really even handle that. You may have to actually have fewer response choices. So this is one item example. Another example item would be this type here. This is from physical function, where you ask people the item stem, does your health now limit you in walking more than a mile? So the item stem refers to health limiting people in walking more than a mile. This is an example of physical function. There's 9 other items in the SF-36 that ask about physical functioning, and they're going to ask about different aspects of physical functioning, from very basic bathing, dressing kind of things, on up to something like this. This is a more vigorous kind of item in the sense that you may get more people saying that if they have limitations in this kind of item than you would in an item that asks them about self-care, because it's harder to do this than it is to bathe and dress yourself. So you try to cover the range of possible limitations that people may have, and then you see that the response scale is a limitation response scale. So it's not none of the time, all the time, because people are not being asked about how much of the time they're being asked, whether they're limited by in this area. And then it could be a yes-no item, but in this case, there's a refinement. It's limited a little versus limited a lot. So you get a little bit of a distinction in people's minds about they could be limited, but maybe they're just limited a little, or they could be limited a lot. So you try to find out a little bit more about the degree of limitation by breaking up yes into two response categories. Okay, so those are just two of the items of the 35 that are used to score the 8 different scales in the SF-36. Actually, this is a typo here. I see at the top. It should be 0 to 100, not 0 to 10 scoring. So there should be another 0 there. But when this measure was first developed, and there's still measures like it, the primary way it was scored was take the existing responses that you get, score them all in the same direction so that when someone gave you a high response, then it means that they're more positive in their health. So you reverse score some items to make everything go in the same direction so that higher means better. And then it was transformed so that you would have a range between 0 and 100. So 0 would be worst possible health, and 100 is the best possible health. In order to do that, you're going to have a set of items that have been administered and maybe coded just in terms of 1, 2, 3 if there are 3 response choices, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 if there are 5 response choices. So you can code it that way to start off with, but then it gets transformed so that the highest possible response is 100 and the lowest possible response is 0. So it's percent of total possible type scoring. And the reason this is useful is that then you always know, well, if they're close to 100, that means in that area they're doing about as good as you possibly can, at least in terms of our measurement. If they're close to 0, they're doing about as bad as they possibly can. So these things were scored so that you would take whatever the raw score was, once it's been changed to the same direction, and so a higher is better, that original raw score would then be, you'd subtract the minimum from it, multiply it by 100, and then divide by the possible range. That would put it so that it's on a 0 to 100 possible range. Then you would average together the items that are measuring the same thing. So every item gets transformed in this 0 to 100 possible range, and then you average the items together and you get a score that is an average of the items for that concept. It's a more reliable and valid score than a single item is. So just show you an example. With the physical functioning scale, the longest scale there is, here are the full set of 10 questions that are asked. So there's a lead-in, falling items are about activities you might do during a typical day, and then does your health now limit you in these activities? And if so, how much? So there's yes-no item stem in the sense of does your health now limit you, but then it's if so, how much? That gets at the idea. If they say yes, you want to know are they limited a little or a lot. And as you can see, we have the item we looked at earlier, like walking more than a mile, but we also have a lot of other activities that are represented here, from the most basic bathing or dressing yourself. We also have walking, lifting or carrying groceries, just a range of physical functioning activities that may be of interest. And if we take the response scale, this response scale is used for every one of these items. Yes, limited a lot, yes, limited a little, and no, not limited at all. And when the data is first collected and people have filled it out, you may have 1 who represents yes, limited a lot, 2, yes, limited a little, and 3, not limited at all, basically. You would then take that data and transform it for each item so that it represents what's shown at the bottom here. So no, not limited at all is 100. 0 would be yes, limited a lot, and yes, limited a little would get 50. That would be what ends up happening when you do the 0 to 100 transformation, is that you have equal steps between each response category. The distances are equal, but you've stretched it so it's on a 0 to 100 possible range. So that's all you're doing, is just so that every item gets scored this way, so that the most positive health response is always 100 and the worst is 0, and then everything else falls in between. Yes?
Are these items all seen as equivalent, or are they weighted differently to items or something?
Typically, in the way these things have been used, is they're treated basically is equal. Now, that's not always the case. In fact, there's work going on now that weights them basically based on their contribution to the overall scale score. So there's a thing that we're not talking about today, but it's item response theory, if you want to read about it, that came out of educational testing, where, you know, when people take the GRE and the SAT and all that, the whole math behind picking items that are most informative for you as an individual. And this is actually a perfect example of a scale that fits that kind of model really well, in that the weighting that actually is done, the best weighting, is a weighting that's specific to the respondent. So probably almost everybody in this room, you wouldn't want to be asking the easy questions like bathing or dressing yourself, because they're really too easy, so you know the response already, and they're not really...
They didn't take a shower today.
That would be a better item, yeah, probably. But I don't know how that would scale. But what we want to do is really pick items, and computer adaptive testing would allow you to do that. First you ask a question, and if someone says they don't have limitations, then you'd ask them a harder level of activity. And you try to ratchet into the point that it really is close to where their true physical functioning is. And that would give greater weight to the items that really, the best item for any person is an item that they're going to have sort of a 50-50 chance of scoring high or low on. So in that way, you're going to overweight items the best in terms of giving information about an individual patient. So that's where it's going in terms of ultimate weighting. A step in that direction would be, well, maybe one of these items correlates more highly with the total score, so you could actually give it greater weight for that reason, because an item that correlates better with the total score is representing the total score. You know, like the sum of the other items is the total score. That would be a better item than an item that's uncorrelated. Like, let's say this item 10 had no correlation with the other items. Well, first of all, you shouldn't even have that item in the scale, because these items should all be positively correlated if they're measuring the same thing. But if it had a low correlation, you may downweight it because it's really not giving you as much information about the concept as the other ones do. But just typically, people, when they started doing this and still do it, they're just treating them the same. They just give you a score and average them together. They don't differentially weight them. One of the reasons that that's not such a bad idea is even if you do differentially weight them, I mean, you do have more potential for doing better, but typically that score is so highly correlated with an unweighted score that it almost doesn't matter for group applications. If you're really interested in an individual score, like for clinical purpose, then you want to get the most accuracy, then differentially weighting could be really important. But for research studies, you almost get the same result regardless of how you weight.
This is why I'm asking, or why I'm thinking about it. Everything that you're saying, it seems like we're focused on people's perception of how an illness
right.
limit them, not necessarily objectively how it limits them.
Right.
And so for something like lifting or carrying groceries, maybe on an objective scale, that's not that big of a deal, but maybe to an individual, that's something that really makes me feel that my life has changed a lot.
Right.
I can't lift groceries. And so depending, it seems that the weighting could be...
Yeah, you could individualize the weighting too. You could say which of these, some measures do say, you know, what's important to you, and someone would say, well, the only thing that's important is lifting or carrying groceries, or it's a lot more important than other things.
Right.
And you could actually take that into account. There are measures that will do that, that will weight based on perceived importance. It's just it's a lot more effort to collect the data. It takes a lot more time, and is the payoff really going to be worth it to you or not? If you think there's a lot of cases, especially at the individual level, where that matters, in theory it could. But in reality, a lot of times it doesn't. It's not worth the extra effort. Now, it doesn't mean I always never do it. There are some people who would say, yeah, you always should do that. This approach is more crude, really, but it's a more typical approach where you kind of say, well, it kind of averages out overall. And as long as I ask about everything, you know, people's values are relatively similar. But, you know, that doesn't hold up in special cases for sure. And especially, like, even with this scale, if you ask there's a whole literature on disabled population where they don't even like these questions at all. So they would say their value on these questions, some of these questions especially, would be really low. Like, there are five of the questions that refer to walking or climbing. And so there's actually been a whole literature. In fact, we've written an article, too, that says you shouldn't even be asking those questions of people in a wheelchair because they can't do it. So they don't know how to answer the question. So then, in fact, there's an article on quality of life research. This issue, you can look in there, and it'll be about a disabled version of the SF-36 where it sort of modifies these to say, well, can I get up a flight of stairs? Not can I walk it, but am I able to get up it, you know? But that all comes from the idea of, you know, some of these things are not so important to some subgroups as others. And yeah, you can get really nuanced in the way you treat these things. The typical approach is not. It's kind of to average that out and not worry about it. But you always have to sort of think, does it matter in this situation, and should I? And definitely in terms of one thing that people do too, is look at individual items to see how well they predict, like overall ratings. You know, overall, how would you rate your health? Well, maybe it is that this particular item is the best predictor of that, and then you'd say, well, it's a more important item for that reason. Okay, so just to take that, though, as an example, so you take the 10 items, you put all those items in 0 to 100 range and average together. If you got 100, that means you have no limitations. If you got 0, that means you would limit a lot in all 10 areas. Well, for most people today, including myself, my score on this physical functioning scale is 100. 0 to 100 possible range, I'm at 100 because I have no limitations in any of those 10 areas. And that's not saying that I'm really super physical functioning type person. It's just that the items actually, for a general population, don't really distinguish that well in terms of physical functioning at the top end of the scale. Most of the emphasis is really on the sicker people where you're trying to make distinctions there. And if you're kind of not too chronically ill or have much in the way of limitations, then you're probably going to score at 100. In fact, the mean score is 87 in the U.S. general population for males. And 75th percentile is 100. So, you know, there's only 25% that score below 100 of the ceiling. That's called a ceiling effect. And that may be okay. You generally don't like a high ceiling effect or measures, but may be okay if you don't really need to make those distinctions at the top end of the scale. But assuming I start off there, just to give an idea of how my score could change, there might be an intervention. Now, by intervention, I don't mean necessarily medical intervention. It could be a life intervention. And the life intervention could be that I'm hit by a rock. And if someone throws a rock at my knee, and then that makes me feel limited a little in vigorous activities. So vigorous activities is one of the hardest of those 10 items. Some people would say it's the hardest to actually say you're not limited in. So it's easier to say you're limited. Well, if I get hit by a rock, maybe it does limit me a little bit, my vigorous activities, because I'm limping around. That would bring my score down to 95, right here. And so that 5-point drop, and the standard deviation is about 20 on this physical functioning scale, so that's a drop of about 0.25 standard deviations. And in terms of effect sizes in general, an effect size of 0.2 is considered a small effect size. So it's not a big change, it's a small change, but it's a note. It's something that you'd want to pay attention to. It's certainly not something to ignore. So getting hit by a rock could have an effect on me that's something that it's small, but still not something you want to ignore. Then another intervention, which might be more extensive, is I get hit by a bike instead. I'm walking down back to my office, and someone runs into me with a bike. So that's bigger than a rock. And maybe in that case, I end up getting limited a lot in vigorous activities and in climbing several flights of stairs. Again, those are things that are easier to be limited in. And I'm limited a little in moderate activities, something that's not as hard to do, but still I have some impact. Then that would bring my score down to 75 here, which is a 25-point drop, which is over a standard deviation drop. And that would be a very large effect size. So that's the kind of thing where if something like I get hit by a bike, that could have an impact on my physical functioning that would be quite a dramatic effect. Okay, so we're kind of running out of time, so I better go fairly quick on this. So that's sort of the profile, the SF-36, and you can get 8 scale scores. That's what the profile is all about. But some people say, well, that's too much. I've got 8 different things to deal with. I'm looking at intervention A versus B, and, you know, it's hard to tell what's going on when I have 8 different scales. So what's come out is that there's actually summary scores, physical and mental health summary scores, that people like to use, at least as a starter. And in some cases, you know, they may look at both the summary scores and the individual scale scores. But when you look at the data, what you find is that all these things are correlated. They're not correlated to a large degree, but at least to a moderate degree, the way people are on one dimension, they are on another. So they have a lot of pain. They tend to be in not functioning as well physically, and so on. So there are categories of things that go together, and one of those is physical health. So physical function, role limitations due to physical health problems, pain, and general health go together pretty well to form what we would consider a physical health composite or summary score. If you look empirically at the data, like in a factor analysis, those four scales tend to cluster together. Now, the general health part is the one that's a little bit more unique of those scales, and that's why I have it underlined, because as you might expect, if you ask people in general, how would you rate their health? Hopefully, they're also telling you about mental health. So they're actually going to tell you more about physical health in the U.S. than they are about mental health, but it also captures a fair amount of their mental health. So even though I show it here as being part of this physical health composite, it actually tells you something non-trivial about their mental health, too. And mental health is the other four scales. So emotional well-being, role limitations due to emotional problems, energy, and social function are a little bit more about mental health. In some cases, a lot more, but energy and social function, they're more about mental health than they are physical health. They also tell you a substantial amount about people's physical health. So you've got these eight scale scores. You can look at how they relate to one another, and now you can form these composites if you want to look at a higher level and summarize in terms of physical and mental health more generally. And the way this actually gets implemented is by using factor analytic scoring weights. So there's a physical component summary score there at the top left. There's a mental component summary score, the lower part of this. And you take the existing scale scores and you create, in this case, a weighted composite. So back to your question, in this sense, when you're creating these summary scores, you can see that some of these things get differential weight. So in a way, physical functioning is really weighted most heavily in scoring this physical component summary score. And that's because physical functioning is actually a better indicator of physical health than anything else. And then the next most weight goes to role limitations due to physical health problems. That's what this is telling you. And then pain is third, general health is fourth. And then you get some interesting things. They're essentially close to zero, and you actually get some negative coefficients for the mental health scales in terms of their impact on physical health. For mental health, the biggest weight is going to be for emotional well-being, then role limitations due to emotional problems and social function, and energy. And you've got some things that are close to zero, and you actually have some negative weights for the more physical health scales. So you get these weighted combinations of the scale scores that will produce physical and mental summary scores. This is based on a Z-score metric here, which means the mean zero and standard deviation is 1. And then they get transformed to what's known as T-scores using the formula that's shown in the bottom left. That's just a way to express the data so that people can interpret it. So 0 to 100 was the way these things were scored originally. And now everything is starting to get expressed as T-scores. And the reason that's happened, it started with these summary scores, the physical and mental summary scores, where you have a T-score now that has a mean of 50 and a standard deviation of 10 in the U.S. general population. So the reason this transformation has gone further to this point is because now you can look at every scale score as well as the summary scores, and they're all on the same metric and the same of having a fixed mean and standard deviation. Every score has a mean of 50 and standard deviation of 10 in the U.S. general population. In the 0 to 100 version of it, you didn't know what the mean and standard deviation was. It varied depending on the scale. So when you try to interpret those numbers, you need to know the mean and standard deviation. Here, you don't have to think about it because you've done a transformation that will put everything on a metric so that the mean is 15 and standard deviation is 10. And the way you do that is you first create a Z-score, which a lot of you are probably familiar with, where the Z-score, if we did a class test, the mean would be 0 and standard deviation is 10. So if you had a 0 in a Z-score metric, you're right at the average. If you have a 1, you're 1 standard deviation above. If you had negative 1, you're 1 standard deviation below. So it makes everything relative to the standard deviation, what your score is. But you can also transform that to any other kind of score you want. And a T-score is a special case where instead of a mean of 0, you have a mean of 50. Instead of a standard deviation of 1, you have a standard deviation of 10. This just comes out of testing the T-scores you're using, so the Z-scores, because it's unlikely you'll get a negative number, and people don't like negative numbers for their scores. So it's just an arbitrary standard. But the Z-score, you always take the observed score, subtract out the sample or population mean, whatever you're trying to reference it to, and then divide by the standard deviation. If you do that for every score, you get a set of Z-scores. Once you do that, you can create any target mean and standard deviation you want using this formula. So if you put in the target mean being 50 and the target standard deviation being 10, you multiply the z-score times that target standard deviation, you're going to get a set of scores that have whatever mean and standard deviation you want. In this case, a t-square distribution that would have 50 as the mean and 10 as the standard deviation. So that makes interpreting these different scale scores easy. So how do we use these? This is an example of these profile measures. Now, just focusing, though, on the aggregate physical and mental health summary scores, what you see here is from Hyksos, a study of HIV. If you look at mental health is red, yellow is physical health, and you look within this by CDC stage, what you see is that mental health is the same for those with AIDS symptomatic and those who are asymptomatic. It's about 40 on this T-score metric, where 50 is a U.S. general population mean. So one standard deviation below is a standard deviation of 10 for everybody with HIV in the U.S. national sample. So they have a hit in terms of their mental health, and it doesn't seem to vary by stage. Whereas with physical function, their physical health is right at the average of the U.S. general population if they're asymptomatic. So people with HIV who haven't got symptoms yet, they're doing just as well in terms of physical function as everybody else in the general population. But once they become symptomatic, they go down by a standard deviation, and then when they have AIDS, they go down by another standard deviation. And these differences are huge. So when you go down by a standard deviation, that's a large change. And so what you can do now with these kind of measures now that are generic is compare different disease groups. And so you can see relative to all these disease groups how they're doing. People with diabetes, there's their mental health, not different from the U.S. general population, but their physical health is down here below 40. So that's more than a standard deviation worse. Here's ESRD, the physical health is even worse. MS is even worse, and so on. So all this depends on what sample you've got and the characteristics of the people in the sample, but it gives you an opportunity to now say, let's compare our sample with other groups that have completed the same questionnaire. This is just quickly to show you that these things do predict things that are important. This physical component summary score actually predicts five-year mortality, so people who are measured in terms of PCS at baseline, you can predict 5 years later what their mortality rate is. They've scored really low. They're in this first bar here. And they're 17% of them ended up dying 5 years later. If you were in the middle, you were 6 to 5% died. If you had a really high positive score, then only 2% of those died. This was from the medical outcome study. So a longitudinal study following people over time. And this is very typical of these measures in general, that they do tell you pretty well about mortality, and that's even adjusting for other variables. Clinical measures have unique associations with mortality and other outcomes. Okay, I just want to quickly say we have the generic profile measure, then we have another category, which is a disease-targeted profile measure. So generic is designed to be relevant to everyone. The other type of measure would be designed to be specific to some group. And the kind of questions you have would be in this, like, kidney disease targeted item. This is from the Kidney Disease Quality of Life Instrument. And we're asking people during the last 30 days, to what extent were you bothered by each of the following? Well, here's the choices: cramps during dialysis, feeling washed out or drained. You can see that these are a different flavor of items. These are not items that you can ask anyone, because you can't answer them unless it applies to you, unless you're on dialysis. So that's the main distinction to keep in mind. When people talk about disease-targeted, what they mean is that they've been designed to be specific or relevant to a certain characteristic. And often people will combine a generic profile with a disease-targeted set of items to get the best sense. They can compare with other groups, but they can also look with detail within one group that they're interested in. Okay, the final thing I want to cover about...
You got that.
Okay. But the final thing is a preference-based measure. So you've got a lot of information in generic profile. You might get a lot of information in disease-targeted. You can summarize the generic profile measures into maybe physical and mental health. Maybe some people would even summarize it into social health. They get a third summary aggregate. But that still may not be enough. For some purposes, you still want only one piece of information, and that's what a preference measure tries to do. So depending on how people are going to use their measures, they may pick different ones, or maybe they'll want to look at all of these. They'll want to look at, but they'll want to get to maybe a preference-based measure that's going to give them a single summary measure. And so the reason they might want that is for a variety of reasons, but one might be for cost-effectiveness analysis, where they see they estimate how much the care is going to cost of some type, and then they say, what is it going to produce in terms of health-related quality of life? And they summarize health-related quality of life in one number. They don't want a bunch of numbers. They want a bottom-line effectiveness indicator. So they want to reduce this ratio, cost over effectiveness. They want the smallest ratio possible. And by looking at both costs and outcomes together, they can get sort of a bottom line for decision making. But they need one number to do that, and that would be cost utility, actually, is the formal terminology. So why would they want this single number? They'd want it for that purpose, but they'd also want it because when you're doing a comparison of two treatments, treatment X versus O, for example, even with two numbers, you may look at your results and have this kind of result here, where X is new treatment. On physical health, it looks better because a higher score is better. This is up to 0 to 100 scoring. And here, with mental health, O looks better than X. So if you're looking at that data, you're trying to decide, well, is X better than O? Someone might say, well, X is better than O because the distance between X and O is bigger here than the distance here. Someone else might say O is better than X because they really care about mental health. Kind of going back to your question again, they may say, well, you've got physical and mental health. I care more about mental health, and so I'm going to go with O. So when you have even two measures, they may be in different directions when you're comparing two groups or more than two groups, whatever you happen to be doing. So that leaves you in a quandary if you don't have a single summary measure. So that's one reason you might want a single summary measure as well. The other reason would be, you can get some weird results if you have a comparison like medication use versus not. And this is a very simple example, but you have five people who don't get medicine, five people who do, and you look at their health-related quality of life, and let's say you even have a single score for it. In this case, you've summarized it into one single number, and it's more like a generic summary measure. But you end up getting a couple people who die in the group that don't have medicine. So what do you do with the people who die? The standard way that we go about measuring these things in the profile sense doesn't allow us to incorporate death into it. So you just ignore those two people and average the data that you get. When you do that, it looks like those people who didn't have medicine are better on average than those who got medicine. But we know by looking at this that that's because two of the people died in the no medicine group and they're not being counted. So the 75 is the average of the living, so is the 50. Turns out the two people who didn't get medicine, they may have died because they didn't get the medicine. So the preference-based measure is designed not only to give you that single number, but to deal with this situation where you may have people who die and to incorporate that. So how does it do that? Well, in survival analysis, the reason you have that is because some people live and some people die. And so you give a 1 to people that are alive and a 0 to people that die. Well, that's a step that's important for us to keep in mind here as we're going to a preference-based measure. But the problem with survival analysis is that everybody is in this who's alive is 1.0. So if you're alive, you're getting treated the same. There's a lot of variation there potentially. You could have someone who's a runner and a person who's in a coma and they're getting treated exactly the same. They're both getting 1, but we know that the health-related quality of life is varying by in those two people. It also may be the case that you have the same people that are runners or in a coma, like this example. No, I'm just kidding about that. So
who is in coma?
The twins. But the idea of the survival analysis is now going to be folded into the preference-based analysis. So we have the generic profile measures. Maybe we can summarize those in a single score, but we don't want to stop there. We actually want to fold in the idea of how do we represent those people who have died. So what happens is that there are measures out there that actually rate people's health-related quality of life relative to being dead. Essentially, that's how they're actually able to capture mortality as well as the health-related quality of life part. So it's a lot of detail about the methods that are used, but basically you say 0 is as bad as being dead, 1 is perfect health, You get a sample of people from the community to rate every possible health-related quality of life state that you can collect and classify people into, and then you've got a category or set of numbers that would say, if you have no limitations, we're going to give you one. If you're dead, we're going to give you zero. If you're at a health state that is as bad as being dead, we're going to give you zero. And then everybody else is going to be basically between zero and one. So we've got one single number that is going to be zero if you're dead or as bad as being dead, and it's going to be something above that if you've got a state that's better than being dead. And with that single number, you could actually plot quality of life for people starting where one is the best and then look over time for them until they die. And when they die, they get a zero. So you could actually integrate the health-related quality of life in theory for an individual over time. And as they get sicker and into worse health state, they're going to go down in their single score until they die at the end. And then they're going to get zero and zero from then on. So that's the idea of these preference-based measures, is there a single score that's going to take into account whether you're dead or not, whether you're as bad as being dead in your particular state and where you happen to be at that particular point in time. If you measure continually over time, you could get this graph for an individual. In reality, it gets used with a limited set of longitudinal data, and then you basically do your best job to estimate what the course of life is for people in different groups, so that you would be in this group potentially if you had intervention, but if you didn't have intervention, you'd be in that group, and you'd say, on average, here's how people do if they don't have this intervention, here's how they do on average if they do have the intervention. You'd plot as many points as you could, as many as would be affordable to collect. And there's, again, from 0 to 1, where 1 is perfect, 0 is as bad as being dead. And you'd look to say, what's the integration between these two curves? That area between the two curves is really the benefit in a summary measure of the intervention in terms of what it produces in terms of health-related quality of life or quality-adjusted life years. That's the effectiveness part in one single summary measure across the two groups that are compared. And then what you would need is cost to say, well, how much did it cost to produce that gain in health-related quality of life? And then you can compare, in theory, two different interventions or any number of interventions that are going to produce different benefits. This is the benefit, in theory, of this one. Another one may have more benefit, may have less benefit. And then you can also have cost, so you get a cost over quality-adjusted life you produce by different interventions to stack one up relative to another in terms of how cost-effective they are. Okay. This is just a reference in case you want to see about health-related quality of life data and its reliability compared to standard clinical data. The bottom line is that you get relatively similar reliability for these kind of data, if they're collected properly, as you do with clinical measures. And then I'm going to stop since we're running over now. Yes.
Thank you very much. I think it's important for you, the idea is this is a whole methodology and technique that you need to learn in order to assist one aspect of some kind of intervention, and this is any kind of disease or whatever, etc. And it takes time to learn about this methodology, so that's the reason why we want you to, for you to be aware of this kind of element, that it requires further training. And the only way you can understand this is by working with people like him that can give you this kind of perspective on whatever you want to study. You know, so it's interesting to me because this technique is really totally new. It's been developed in the early 80s. It's unbelievable. You know, it's only 20 years old, 25 years old. It didn't exist 10 years ago. So this is really pretty cool. This is pretty amazing.
Yeah, there's been a huge increase in the amount of activity over the last 5 years or so, and it seems to keep, it hasn't asymptoted yet. So
yeah, the other thing to me, which is interesting now, is you do it for the, you talk about adult 18 and above, but there are some things for children and also for the geriatric population, and they cannot be designed to readjust all this score according to the you know, the population where you want to address or study this effect of disease or consequence of disease or health, basically.
Referring to the pediatric population, you mentioned that short form. Is there an equivalent that can be used for infants, toddlers, or children? Does it rely mainly upon parent report or observation?
There's not as much work, but there's a pediatrics quality of life instrument that someone from San Diego, James Varney, developed, and now he's in Texas. Unfortunately, he's kind of restrictive. Some people, if you do, they're kind of restrictive, and they have little charges for it. But he's developed a questionnaire that there actually is parent report, but there's also child self-report. And kind of the standard approach is to get as much data as you can from the child, but also to get some from the parent so that you kind of supplement it. So he's one example, but there's also a child health questionnaire that John Ware developed with Gene Landgraf from New England Medical Center when they were there. So that's another option, but that's also proprietary. And then there's some in Europe that have been developed. There's Monica Bollinger from Germany who has, I forget what the acronym is, but it's like a kids QL type thing. So there are like about four leading instruments, and there was one at Johns Hopkins too. And they all pretty much have the same approach. They have heavy emphasis on parent report, but they also try to get the child whenever they can. And if you want a reference, there's like a review article that I could send you, and it's also on my site.
I found several versions of FXR disease online, and lots of them really. And the question is that, are you allowed to modify this FXR disease according to your needs?
That's a good general question. I don't think it's specific to SF36. I mean, first of all, there should be not too many. Unfortunately, with the SF36, the same thing kind of got copyrighted several times, and there's a little bit of confusion there. But the one that you would probably want to focus on is version 2 of the SF36. That it's sometimes hard to find, but Quality Metrics distributes it, but they try to charge you a lot of money from using it. So you might try to find someone around here like Mark Litwin in urology who uses it, you know, and has it up on his website. But look for version 2, that's the one. And just in general about changing these things, you can change them, but typically it's at your risk. So a lot of times people will just administer it the way it is, even though they may feel like, well, I don't like the way this question is worded, because then when you try to publish your data, someone's going to say, you didn't administer that, you changed it, and we have no idea what effect it had on the results, so they're not comparable. So you have to kind of balance that. More typically, it would be better if you wanted to administer some subset. There's also the SF12, which is an even shorter version, so maybe you can administer that and then change the wording of the items and put that in a different set of questions and say, okay, I've got the standard version, but I also have a variant on it, or you know, whatever you're interested in testing out is kind of separated from keeping the, quote, standard instrument intact.
So it's something really that you cannot modify
according to your needs. No, you can. I'm just saying if you do, though, do it at your risk. And that, you know, if you want to make that comparison to all the data that's been collected, you should keep that part the same. But, you know, the safe thing would be keep that the same, then you could modify, you know, like later in the questionnaire. So let's say you took one of the items like, you know, vigorous activities, and you think vigorous is not the right word. You could ask the same question later in the questionnaire, but substitute whatever you want in there instead. Then you'll have the data on your question as well as the quote standard question. Yes?
How correlated are the questionnaire measures with the economic measure? If you're doing a cost effectiveness analysis, can you use whichever one's easier? Or
you mean cost kind of estimate by economic? Or?
So if you're using a utility-based measurement, is it equivalent to how correlated are they with the questionnaire measurements? So if you're using, standard gamble?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, so, like there's indirect measures like the EQ5D, the Health Utilities Index. The SF36 actually has something called the SF6D that produced the single score I was talking about. They're called indirect because there's society weights that have been given to it that are then used to score everybody who happens to fill out a set of health status questions. So depending on how I answer it, I'm going to be put between 0 and 1, and everybody that answered like I did is going to be put between 0 and 1 with the same score. That kind of thing is going to be very highly correlated with the generic profile kind of score because it's kind of coming out of it because they're sort of derived from a generic profile. So all that's been done there is a weighting of those existing scores to produce a single summary score, so that'll be highly weighted. But the other approach, the direct preference approach, like the standard gamble and time trade-off, means you sit down as a person and you go through this exercise that says, how do I value my health directly? That will be correlated, because people who are in better health are going to tend to also value it highly, and those who are in lower health are going to tend to value it lowly, but it won't be as highly correlated. So I can't say exactly what it is, but if I did a standard gamble on someone, I wouldn't be surprised that that score would correlate 0.5, sort of a moderate correlation, with an SF-36 score. There would be a lot more variation, just depending on my individual preferences, that either are not captured directly in the SF-36, or it's just because of the idiosyncratic way that I value my health, like you said before. You know, maybe there's one thing that's really driving it. So there will be a positive correlation. It will probably be moderate, is my best guess, if you get a direct preference assessment.
So if you're doing a cost effectiveness analysis, it sounds like it's better to use two different measures, the economic-based and the SF-36.
Well, it's always better if you can, but the problem, you know, there's always this big debate about, like, the standard gamble and these direct preference approaches. Do people really understand it or not? But, you know, you have a camp of people, the economist type, who really like those. They think that's the proper way to elicit utilities. If you're trying to publish for them or convince them, you need that. Or you need, you know, like the health utilities index. You know, a lot of those will buy into that. The real extreme people would say, no, you actually have to go directly to the person. But that's a lot more burden and time, and you have to worry about people who don't understand it and stuff. So it's always better if you have all the data, but it's not always practical. So maybe an indirect measure will be kind of a good compromise in a lot of cases. So that's why they were developed, because then you don't have to spend all the time eliciting the preferences. You just apply existing societal preferences to everybody's score. But if the instrument was designed for that purpose, like the Health Intelligence Index. But now, you know, with the SF-36, you can actually get an estimate. It's just, you know, some people don't like it. You know, John Brager developed it from the UK. Someone else who has the Health Utilities Index or the Quality Well-Being Scale, which Bob Kaplan, who's in health services, may say, well, here's the problem with that. It wasn't designed to be used that way, and sort of it's ad hoc, and it produces, you know, not as good of estimates. So you're always going to have potential debate with people, but, you know, the indirect is probably most commonly used for that reason, because of the compromise between practical and being able to at least get some estimate that's a utility, a somewhat economic estimate.
One of the things that is important with this kind of methodology is kind of investigate. You know, last week when we talked about this deep one, like what Michelle worked, translational research, that also the dialogue between this type of investigator and the other type, it should be enhanced. And so people have expertise on, you know, their specific area, and they have expertise on some specific area of medicine, whatever. And so if they, from the conclusion of their work, you know, they can raise questions that, you know, basic science investigator or other who can look at things. And the important thing that we need to maximize this dialogue. A lot of the things, you know, they work on their end, we work on our own end, and people don't talk too much. And so a little bit of the future, what NIH is trying to push, is that this type of medicine, you know, the groups, you know, what we call this new team science that we've been talking, you know, you have these kind of people also working together with the other group and trying to move things forward. And that's really, hopefully, what's happening in the near future more.
Yeah. Well, I guess that you're not exactly saying that, but the other thing is, depending on who you talk to, you might get different opinions.
Yeah.
So one of the things about this field is, you know, like the QWB, if you work with Bob Kaplan, I'm sure he's going to promote his measure. The SF-36, if you develop, you know, the people that work with that, they're going to promote it. So you also have
to be bring Bob Kaplan.
Yeah, but you also have to be skeptical. I mean, that's, you're going into that world of people, but then you have to realize that there's the bias within the world, and probably the best person is someone who's kind of not really invested too much in one particular measure, and is going to tell you, well, if you do this, here's what might happen if you do that one. You know, you could use them all. That's always the best thing, but maybe, you know, you can't do that. So here's what you're going to anticipate. You know, if you go this way, be prepared. Just like, you know, if you want to change it, sure,
That's a great thing. I did that like one of my first studies with the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. It's true false. I just changed it to strongly agree to strongly disagree. And I tried to publish it, and then they said, it completely changed this measure. It's no good. You know, when I thought, well, it's actually going to be better because there are more response choices. I'll get more precision and so forth. So I kind of learned my lesson then. And it's just always, well, maybe it's worth doing it, but be prepared to argue that or have data to show it's better. And then you still may get people who say, well, what you did was not appropriate. You know.
All right.
All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Ron.
Thank you.
You know, the original, the lecture that Michelle did last week, normally she does it at the end of his talk. And so the groups are wondering, and start working on the groups and the theory that we Thank you.